It's not often you hear Plato brought up with respect to leadership. Don't worry, this isn't going to be some sort of high-level philosophical discussion. As ever, we cover topics here that are timeless, so believe it or not, Plato's ideas about the rule of law are even more essential to explore today. Professor Melissa Lane is here to remind us.
Philosophy really for the Greeks is about dialogue. And it not only begins in dialogue, but actually in Plato's Republic, the height of philosophical understanding and wisdom is actually dialectic, which is practiced as dialogue. It's the exchanging of reasons, the testing of reasons, the giving and taking of reasons, and of the giving and taking of an account, which is actually what philosophy, even at its kind of most esoteric and high-reaching, that's what it is.
Our willingness and ability to engage in dialogue with each other over anything is subject to the give and take of conversation. And when we require accountability from our leaders, we expect that that tradition of questions and answers is a tradition that'll still be upheld today, just as it was in Plato's time.
When he talks about the kind of virtue and wisdom that people need to lead, it's as much about having the ethical virtues, which will mean that you're not greedy, you're not interested in using power for your own advantage. You're actually oriented to service. So our idea of a public servant, which has sort of become a cliche and almost a sort of worn out cliche for the Greek, this paradox that was hard to achieve, because by being in power, people might feel like, you know, they're in charge, they're supreme, they're better than everybody else. And so how do you cultivate that idea of being a servant leader? That, I think, is intrinsic to Plato's thought.
These kinds of thoughts are relevant today as accountability and public service seem to be on a collision course. Join me as I engage in a fascinating dialogue on the latest insights from 2,500-year-old ideas on virtue, accountability, power, and leadership. Insights that reflect timeless leadership. This is Timeless Leadership, where we explore the values and principles that drive extraordinary leaders. We look for the timeless virtues that are just as relevant in the 21st century as they were in the first century. Universal truths that will help make us better versions of ourselves. Hi, I'm Scott Monte. Welcome to Timeless Leadership. Every other week, I speak with someone who has fascinating and timeless ideas that we can apply to leadership. Alternating weeks, you have an essay, just me and you. It's about 10, 15 minutes long. But this is one of those weeks when we have an interview. And I mentioned this in previous episodes, but I wanted to share it again because maybe you're a new listener. Timeless Leadership has been named a top 50 podcast in the management category on Good Pods. And we recently reached the number 12 spot, thanks to listeners like you. If you'd like to check us out on Good Pods, I've got a link to it in the show notes. But of course, you can listen to us wherever you get your podcasts. I've had lots of new subscribers to the Timeless and Timely newsletter. Make sure you're subscribed. It's a weekly publication for people who are lifelong learners and are looking for answers for today's challenges, perhaps through stories of the past. And if you're subscribed and you refer other people, you can actually get access to our paid tier of membership. Now, our paid memberships, who are members of what we call the Ampersand Guild, are people who pay for access to the newsletter and bonus episodes of the podcast. They also get full access to the archives, the ability to comment, and I do monthly Q&A sessions on leadership and business. And even if you only tell one other person about Timeless and Timely, it makes it possible for even more people to learn and grow on their leadership journey. M- Melissa Lane is the class of 1943 professor of politics at Princeton University and director of the University Center for Human Values. She's also an associated faculty member in the Department of Classics and the Department of Philosophy at Princeton. As of August 2023, for a term of 3 academic years, she's also the 50th professor of rhetoric at Gresham College, a non-degree-granting institution founded in London in 1597. She's delivering an extended series of public lectures, which are available online. Professor Lane served as a trustee and chair of the editorial board of the Princeton University Press. She was awarded a 2015 Phi Beta Kappa Teaching Prize at Princeton and a 2012 fellowship of the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation in the field of classics. Lane's newest book, Of Rule and Office, Plato's Ideas of the Political, sheds light on the timeless connection between leadership and accountability, providing a through line from ancient to modern times. Melissa Lane, welcome to Timeless Leadership.
Hello, Scott. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it is a pleasure to have a philosopher on here. Not every day I get to do this, although we have had some philosophers on here before, so you're in good company. But just talk to me about what drew you to your profession in the first place.
I think I've always been interested in what are the ideas that animate people's thinking, and kind of more broadly, what are the assumptions, the range of ways in which they imagine the world? What do we take to be normal? What do we think is good or worth doing? And so those are questions that kind of naturally lead you to inquiry. You know, of course, famously, Aristotle says philosophy begins in wonder. And for Plato, you might say it begins in perplexity. And so it's something about being curious about the way that people make sense of their experience. And then also, how are there ways in which that can be transformed? Can we make the world a better place?
Yeah. Wow. You hit exactly on the things we like to talk about here. You know, curiosity and wonder and making the world a better place, and also self-improvement. I mean, this comes through reflection. It comes through slowing down. And I'm sure you must see this every day at Princeton, where you've got a student body, a younger generation that are digital natives. How do you go about helping them pause from the digital effluvia that's coming at us all the time and becoming more reflective and becoming more critical in their thinking? How do you help them with that?
So one thing that I instituted post-pandemic is that I instituted a rule of no laptops in lectures, no electronics. I don't even use PowerPoint. I make old-fashioned paper handouts. And of course, I make an exception for students who need accommodation. I've had blind students in my classes and so on. But apart from that, I encourage conversation during at least part of every lecture. And I find that students are actually hungry for that. You know, that's what they were missing. This generation of students were in high school during the pandemic. They lost out on that opportunity for that kind of conversation focus. And I think it makes you part of that timeless conversation, you know, that people have been discussing philosophical questions orally. That oral conversation has been part of the practice in the ancient world. It was part of the practice in medieval universities. It may be where we're going to go in terms of having, you know, examinations in the age of AI. So I find that asking students to return, to printed books and to conversation and, you know, putting away digital distractions is something that they're actually very, very grateful to experience.
I am so pleased to hear that. Not only personally, because I believe in handwritten notes and actual physical books and stationery and, getting yourself away from the digital distractions. I find that leaders that actually take that on and kind of espouse that to their people, whether they're employees or students or what have you, they get exactly what you're talking about. They get that hunger that comes out, and people end up being more willing to participate. And I full admission here, I was a classics major as an undergrad. at Boston University decades ago. And I remember going to class and having these fascinating discussions. And to me, it was like the old Socratic method, you know, and Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, you know, there's our heritage of teachers and students right there. And we're still seeing it play out today.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the important thing about the Socratic method is that it really is so individual, you know, so it's really Socrates, if he's talking to a general, he asks them about courage, you know, if he's talking to, you know, someone who's bringing a prosecution for on grounds of impiety, he asks them to define piety. So he's really starting from where people are, what their assumptions are, what world they're seeing, and then really asking them to extrapolate, to explain, you know, to test whether their ideas are consistent and, you know, really get to the bottom of what it is that in fact they do care about. And what the Socratic method often finds is that there is some contradiction. There's some tension between what we really think we care about and what we've assumed is the best way to go about it. And often it turns out that might not be the best way, and we have to step back and think again.
And it's interesting. And with my coaching clients, I find them discovering this about themselves. My job is to simply ask questions because they know more about their field than I ever will. But by asking the right questions, or by asking questions that force them to reflect when they're running at, you know, 100 miles an hour in their day-to-day work, suddenly they, saying it out loud, they simply discover something about themselves that, just as you said, perhaps they made false assumptions before, and they end up through that back and forth leading themselves in a new direction.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's so interesting that, you know, philosophy really for the Greeks is about dialogue. And it not only begins in dialogue, but actually in Plato's Republic, the height of philosophical understanding and wisdom is actually dialectic, which is practiced as dialogue. It's the exchanging of reasons, the testing of reasons, the giving and taking of reasons, and of the giving and taking of an account, which is actually what philosophy, even at its kind of most esoteric and, you know, kind of high reaching, that's what it is at bottom. And for me, actually, in my work on Plato, in my recent book of Rule and Office, I argue that that's what links the philosophy and the politics. It's the kind of everyday prosaic example of giving an account in the sense of accountability, you know, for money that you've been responsible for as a political office holder. That the reason you might be better at that is, by studying philosophy, is because philosophy is about giving an account and giving and taking of accounts. And so there's a real continuity with kind of our ordinary practice there.
That fascinates me because, you know, more and more of the business world is moving to embrace and almost worship artificial intelligence. And yet, to me, it seems like those individuals who show up with a knowledge of, you know, the social sciences, social studies and philosophy and all the rest, history, certainly, the ability to understand the implications of ethical decisions and thinking down the road about the human implications, these are the people, I think, who will be more well-versed and prepared for what the world has to offer. And Plato offers that in spades. So I'm interested from your perspective. I mean, Plato has obviously been around for thousands and thousands of years, has been studied to death. And there still seem to be ways to extract new angles, new perspectives, new inspirations. So talk a little bit about how you came to think about Of Rule and Office and how it applies to what we're going through in today's world.
Great. So actually what was wonderful about this is that it really began by noticing something in Plato's writing in ancient Greek, and more generally about ancient Greek, which is that it's the same word that can signify rule and ruling in a generic sense, where it could be a king or it could be even a tyrant potentially, although the sort of more typical use would be for a sense of a good ruler, broadly speaking. That same word, though, could also mean a constitutionally limited term of office. So the word can mean rule and ruling, or it can mean office and office holding. And that idea of a constitutionally limited term of office with, you know, rotation of office, term limits, prerequisites, audits at the end of the term of office, that was a practice that Plato in the 4th century BC was familiar with. That was part of the Athenian democracy that he lived in, and it was part of all of the constitutional regimes, whether they were oligarchies or democracies. And so when I noticed that this word is systematically, in a way, ambiguous in Greek, does it have that very specific limited meaning, you know, where it brings with it these assumptions of accountability, limited powers, term limits, or it can be this much more general idea, I started to think, well, in a lot of Plato's writings, we've assumed that he means this much more general idea. But actually, I think that, and one can even show that there are certain expressions in the Greek that make this more likely, that he often is really reflecting on what is the value of constitutionally limited terms of office? What underlying values are we trying to get at when we seek to hold office holders to account? And then what he's asking is, are there better ways of doing that? Are there more robust ways? What sorts of virtues, education, additional legal constraints would you need in order to make that kind of practice more robust? So what's I think distinctive about my reading is that whereas people have often assumed that, especially in Plato's Republic, he's only interested in a kind of absolute, untrammeled form of rule, once you pay attention to his use of the Greek in this way that I do and see how it ramifies in his writing, you see that he's actually just as interested in constitutionally limited forms of office, and he's interested in thinking about the relationship between rule and office in that way.
Yeah, and to me, it's fascinating because I'm kind of a word nerd anyway. So to hear that this entire argument is based in, the language and vocabulary and usage is fascinating to me. Probably a little too nerdy for most people to appreciate, but I know you can. And it brings me to this thought, too. I took a course back in my old college days with a professor named Meyer Reinhold. And he wrote a book called Classica Americana. And the concept of the course and the book was how the founding fathers were inspired by models of civic government in ancient Greece and Rome. And I have to imagine that as they were putting together our founding documents, they read the original in Greek, just as you have, and they probably parsed over some of this as well. Because this idea of taking care and putting accountability into place really makes its appearance in the Constitution. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So absolutely. And I think that insight is very important. It's most well embodied in John Adams, who wrote a defense of the constitutions of the United States, by which he meant the state constitutions. And in writing that analysis of the different state constitutions at the time that he was living, he brought them into dialogue with ancient Athens, ancient Rome, ancient Sparta, and all the kind of subsequent, different kinds of regime and history of political thought. So just as I'm arguing that Plato was very much in dialogue with the actual political practices of his time, I think the founding fathers were interested in what Plato and Aristotle and Cicero and Livy and Tacitus thought, and they were also interested in how Athens and Sparta and Rome and other ancient regimes were actually governed. So there's a lot to say about that relationship, but as you said, as you noted, I especially think that what's very interesting is these two ideas. So on the one hand, accountability, and how do you genuinely secure that in a way that will be robust against only doing it retrospectively, and sort of therefore people might slip through the cracks. And then this idea of, and so you might do it through legal structures and institutions. And part of what I argue is, again, contrary to the way that we tend to read Plato's Republic, rather than wanting untrammeled rule, he actually says explicitly that the best regime would pass laws that would severely constrain the capacity of rulers and office holders to accumulate wealth, for example. So there's a very specific sort of interesting point there that we could talk about in relation to the Supreme Court, for example. But then he also thinks it's, while you need to bolster those laws and institutions, it's not enough if you don't have people who are animated by the virtues in such a way that they genuinely care about the good of the ruled. So Plato is equally interested in both sides. He's interested in institutions and laws much more than we might have thought, but he's also really interested in how do you cultivate those civic virtues. And it's that kind of interface that, and I think both of those things were of interest to the founding generation, you know, of the American Constitution as well.
Yeah, and they certainly seem to be of interest right now. We are dealing with a profound lack of accountability, I think, and our legal structures, our institutions are being pushed to their limits. And one thing, I don't know if the founding fathers considered this, certainly no Plato did, was the virtue of individuals, of being willing to stand up for what is right and to hold people to account rather than caving and letting them go. What do you think Plato would make of our current situation?
So, of course, it's interesting, like to Plato, our current regime would probably look much more like an oligarchy than a democracy. Not that he was very critical in many ways of democracy. He was also critical of oligarchy, you know, because he thought that all of these regime types in his day, as I think he would think of our current polity, don't actually do enough to educate and test leaders for the virtues. And I think it's very important that this was not a simply technocratic idea of virtues. So often people think that Plato's Republic, when he talks about having philosopher rulers, and he talks about philosopher queens as well as philosopher kings, it's gender neutral, gender open in that way. But many often we think that he only means by philosophy, you know, people who are smart or people who, you know, were educated in his academy, you know, which was the kind of university, the first university, you know, that of his time, as it were. But actually, when he talks about the kind of virtue and wisdom that people need to lead, it's as much about having the ethical virtues, which will mean that you're not greedy, you're not interested in using power for your own advantage. You're actually oriented to service. So our idea of a public servant, which has sort of become a cliche and almost a sort of worn out cliche for the Greeks and not just for Plato, that was a very real idea. And they kind of saw it as this paradox that was hard to achieve because by being in power, people might feel like, you know, they're in charge, they're supreme, they're better than everybody else. And so how do you cultivate that idea of being a servant leader? That, I think, is really an idea which is intrinsic to Plato's thought.
Yeah, and, you know, you talk a little bit about, who then guards the guardians? Because we trust leaders to, as the Constitution says, take care and faithfully execute the laws, but we've got this system of checks and balances now. Plato talked about or had experience with councils. How did that work?
Yeah, so one of the things that I think is so interesting, if we look at how Athens functioned, and then we can actually also think about Rome and also then what Plato is proposing in the Republic or exploring, there's an idea that you have a council of former office holders who've then gone through an accountability check and then are put in a position where they become guardians for life. And their role is to oversee the actual office holders at any given time. So the guarding the guardians is the sense that, okay, there are the people who are in power at any given time, but we need a sort of more temporally extended sense of there are people who were in power before them, and their role can be to check and make sure and test that the current leaders, you know, have in fact exercised their power in the right way and maintain that. So, you know, one of the things that I think is interesting about that is that you might think today that, you know, councils of former presidents, for example, could vet the next president, you know, who comes along and decide whether they think that on balance they've showed the kind of civic virtue that their office required, and took care in the appropriate way that the laws were faithfully executed. And then they would be put onto this council, and then they might have oversight of the sorts of honors that would be accorded to future former presidents. So, for example, you know, should they get Secret Service protection? Should there be a presidential library in their name? Those sorts of civic honors. So Plato, like the Greeks, thinks that you can use virtue, doesn't have to exclude incentives. You can have incentives for people to act virtuously. And one of the important sets of incentives is actually public respect and how people are remembered after their term of office. And so councils of elders can play that role, among others.
Yeah. Do you think it's possible to solve for, I don't know what I would call it, kind of this endemic of lack of care for your public reputation that some people have? They seem to just be plowing through in pursuit of power, regardless of how they are seen by the public. What's the answer to that?
So I think there are two answers. I mean, one answer is there isn't a perfect answer. I think one of the things Plato teaches, and that actually the founding fathers and later generations of thinkers took from him, is that, you know, all regimes are fragile. Any political constitution can be undermined. In a sense, any legal structure, any institution, if people systematically, you know, don't care about what the point of that institution is, if they exploit it or, you know, obey it in name only, you know, or obey the letter but not the spirit, that will undermine a constitution, you know. So in one way, I think Plato teaches us we have to actually take care, because there is no fail-proof solution and, you know, things are more fragile than we might think. The other side of it, though, is that this is where I would also go back to the legal constraints. So I mentioned that Plato's Republic actually says, even for these philosophical and virtuous potential leaders, you know, these people who we think are going to be the maximally wise and educated and virtuous, even they should be subject to stringent limits on their ability to accumulate wealth. And they should, in a sense, this is said explicitly, they should be forced to live off their wages. So the servant leader part here is actually very explicit. They will be paid wages and they should have to live on those wages and not be allowed to accumulate wealth beyond that, because even these most wise and virtuous people could otherwise be tempted to misuse their wealth. So I think, you know, Plato would say, actually, you know, it is meaningful to bolster those sorts of legal constraints, even though, again, no legal constraint is ultimately foolproof if people become so determined to get around it.
Yeah. And that's interesting, too, because, I mean, it comes into play with respect to corporate boards and how they set up compensation packages for executives. And they've been very generous of late. And I think there's a desire to see some of that culled back and to have performance tied to reward. And, you know, I don't know if it makes sense to have any cap on things, but I mean, when you've got individuals now who are almost trillionaires, you have to wonder how much money, how much power does one individual need? It seems like there are, practical applications here as well as political applications for this Platonic ideal.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the sort of most challenging, I think that's a really interesting way to extend the application of it. And I was going to say one of the most challenging things in Plato's idea in the Republic is that it's explicitly argued that the people who should have power are the people, political power, but you could think other kinds of power as well, are the people who don't want that power kind of in the first instance. So they have to be willing to accept it, but they accept it because in some sense they have a sense of higher priorities and they're willing to do this for the public good. There are different arguments about why exactly will they be willing to do it. But the key idea that I want to emphasize here is this idea that they have to be willing to rule even though they don't fundamentally want to rule. They could live a good life and maybe even in some ways a better life if they didn't, but they're willing to do it because it's for the good of others. And what is interesting about that is you do then, that's why you do have to think then about, well, so then what are the appropriate kinds of incentives that can get someone to do that? And that's where I think Plato wants to say, not the incentives of what you do with the power directly. That's what should be very stringently controlled, but the incentive of how you might be remembered after your time. So put much more emphasis into, you know, prizes in your name or, you know, sort of a legacy foundation or that sort of thing. That's the kind of appropriate motivation. It's caring about how your legacy will be thought about, as opposed to how can I feather my nest with the powers that I actually currently have. So that's an important distinction.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, I mean, that plays to a very natural human sense of ego, you know, and we all want to be remembered after we're gone. And to your point, it's how do you want to be remembered and what your legacy says about you? And quite frankly, if you're doing something that affects many people, if you're doing something that improves the world or improves people's existence or allows other people to succeed as well, that just kind of magnifies your impact on them.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, this idea that you take up, I think it's one of the concepts that I've brought to Plato, and this is a contemporary concept, but I found it really necessary to explicate Plato's Greek in a way, or helpful anyway, is the concept of a role. And so the idea is that being a ruler or being a CEO or being a political office holder is a role. And as a role, it has an appropriate orientation, which is caring for the good of those whom you're serving, you know, in the case of political rulers, whom you're ruling. But then there's this question of who are the kinds of people that should be in that role? How do you get people willing to play that role? And how do you try to ensure that they play that role appropriately and don't, you know, kind of misuse the powers that are associated with the role? And so I think that that is very helpful because, you know, no matter how, I mean, the sort of flip side of how you'll be remembered is in some way also institutions will always go on without you, you know, whatever institution you've been part of, whatever you've served, you know, it will go on after you. And so in some way you have to have both those things. Like you want to be appropriately remembered and honored for having done the right thing, but also you have to find sources of satisfaction for yourself that aren't contingent on how others view you, because otherwise, again, you might be tempted to use your power to kind of distort that, to, you know, buy friends or, you know, kind of in other ways, again, serve your own ends. And so that balance between kind of ego having sort of healthy values and healthy self-esteem that doesn't wholly depend on the practice of the role paradoxically makes you a better occupant of that role because you're in it then for the right reasons.
Yeah. I think that's very astute. And speaking of paradoxes, I wanted to touch on the notion of tyranny and anarchy. It would seem, at least to the casual viewer, that tyranny would come with a lot of order behind it. And, you know, usually when we're thinking about a strong man, a dictator, a tyrant, somebody who is, you know, kind of ordering things around and, you know, making everything run a certain way. And yet, present to us that tyranny is simply, or not simply, but is a form of anarchy. Can you kind of help square the two of these and how that thinking goes?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a great question to follow what we were just discussing, because I think this is exactly where the direction that Plato's thought goes. So he thinks, you know, suppose you're this person who's a tyrant, who for the Greeks, as for us, in this context is someone who, you know, apparently has total power, right? Has, you know, overrides the laws or makes the laws only to serve their own good, you know, is untrammeled, unchecked. So as you say, that seems like the person who has kind of maximal power. And many of Plato's contemporaries, and this is depicted in the Republic, would have thought the way to be happy is to have that kind of maximal power. So, you know, we might think today to be a CEO who's unchecked by a board, you know, so you can just do whatever you want, you know, or to be a kind of unchecked. And because, you know, then you can use your powers to serve all your own interests and appetites. So wouldn't that be the path to happiness? And what Plato argues in the Republic, this is the central argument of the Republic, is that actually the tyrant is the most unhappy person because in having these unchecked powers, they're not accountable to anyone, but therefore no one can trust them. So they can't enjoy ordinary interactions with other people. So if you think about a tyrant who has bodyguards, there's always the danger that they'll be assassinated by their bodyguards because they can't trust the bodyguards. The bodyguards know the tyrant only has their own interests at heart and no one else's interests, you know, and may even run roughshod over all the other people and, you know, have them put to death if it serves them. And so the result of all of that is the tyrant can't be happy, but also there's no true order in that society, right? Because there's no law. There's no rule of law because the tyrant can always undermine it and override it. And so that's what makes it ultimately anarchy. The tyrant is not, in a way, occupying a role. They don't see themselves as bounded by the obligations of an office. So anarchia in Greek means literally the absence of an office or the absence of a ruler, the absence of an office or an office holder or of a ruler or a ruler. And so in this sense, the tyrant only seems to be in an office or to be a sort of true ruler, but really there's no structure, there's no order, there's no rule of law, as we would say. And so that's why tyranny ultimately collapses into anarchy. And then all the things that we would see as wrong with anarchy are also wrong with tyranny. It's not the kind of condition in which, you know, human life can really thrive or be fulfilled.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And, you know, when you think about it from the perspective of, a tyrant simply does whatever his whims are, that really leaves us vulnerable to, you know, whatever the prevailing wind of the day happens to be. So,
yeah, exactly. So, and that's right. That's exactly it. It's the tyrant does whatever their whims are, and it leaves their subjects vulnerable, but it also leaves the tyrant in a way hamstrung because they're instrumentalizing everyone else as merely sort of means to this satisfaction of their own whims. Therefore, they can't trust anyone. Therefore, they can't have any true friends. And actually, to me, one of the most poignant moments in Plato's Republic, Book 9 of the Republic, is when Plato's character Socrates says, the tyrant cannot have friends. You know, they cannot enjoy friendship or freedom. So they see, and friendship then, the ability to trust and be trusted, to genuinely interact with other people as peers, that's what the tyrant's own actions makes impossible for them. And that's why ultimately their life is miserable. And I think this is, you know, this is when rulers or any people in any position of authority kind of think of their authority as something only that they instrumentalize for their own purposes. Ultimately, they undermine their own ability to live flourishing lives.
Yeah. Well, as we close out here, I'd like to turn to maybe some practical advice that you could give our listeners, people who are in leadership positions, how they're considering how they approach servant leadership. What are some things that you can recommend to them? Maybe some further reading. I don't know if we want to give them the full-on Plato treatment, but where do you think they can get started in applying some of these lessons?
So I think that really considering what are the ways. So for Plato, the fundamental way to get the right people into these kinds of roles of authority, of power, is through education. And so they might want to think about both what is their own education? Are there ways that they can deepen their own education to be more adequate to the demands of their role? And also, how can they then institute an education within their organization or institution or community that can then bring people up, you know, in the next generation, the next cohort, who will be better educated in order to take on these roles? So that that idea of civic education, but also education within organizations, how do you cultivate a healthy culture? How do you test that the people to whom you're thinking about entrusting power, you know, have used it appropriately in the past, demonstrate that kind of care. I think thinking about those kinds of questions, you know, is a very good place to start.
Huge fan of education and lifelong learning here, so I'm really glad to hear that. Well, the book is Of Rule and Office, Plato's Ideas of the Political by Professor Melissa Lane. Melissa, I want to thank you for sharing these wonderful and timeless ideas with us here on Timeless Leadership.
Thank you, Scott. It's been a pleasure to have this conversation.
As I like to remind people, leaders are curious and lifelong learners. So the idea of education should be natural for all of us. No matter what your leadership position or ambitions are, you should be concerned with your duty of office and the care that you take for those in your charge. How you learn about yourself and how you learn about them will reflect how you act. I'll be back next week with another episode to help you on your leadership journey. I hope you'll join me. Until then, remember that when you help others to dream more, learn more, do more, and become more, you are a leader. I'm Scott Monty. There's so much to learn.